And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
That doesn't sound good.
Paper shredder's jammed, but I think I fixed it.
Oh, well, try shredding these $50 bills then.
Seems like it's working.
Better try another $400.
Stop. Instead of using money, use regular paper. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.
Amateur Traveler, episode 568. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about hidden coves, fishing villages, cliffside walks, and a long walk on the Costa Brava in Spain on the Camino Ronda. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Let's talk about the Camino Ronda.
I'd like to welcome back to the show Sherry Ott, who has come to talk to us about a hiking experience this time in the Costa Brava region of Spain. Sherry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me again.
I say welcome back. This is the sixth episode of Amateur Traveler that Sherry has been on, also two episodes of This Week in Travel, talking about solo travel as a woman, travel in Lebanon, Costa Brava, Nova Scotia, and remote Alaska.
I feel so lucky I've been on this many times.
Well, we've been doing this show for a long time, 2 days from the time we were recording this. We're recording this on the last day of June 2017, and 2 days from now will be the 12th anniversary of Amateur Traveler. So there has been some time.
Yes, and congratulations.
Well, thanks. You are taking us back to Costa Brava, which we have talked about before, but we're doing a very specific trip this time. What are we talking about today?
This kind of unfinished business for me. So when we talked about Costa Brava before, we talked about all the different things you could do there. And there was one little thing in that last podcast where I referenced there was a hiking trail that goes up the coast. I might have even said in that interview that it's something I want to go back and do. I did a day hike on it. And ever since I did that, I've wanted to go back and do the entire thing. And from my standpoint, there was not a lot of information on how to do this hike. So I also really had a goal to go and do it, but also really document it a little better for Americans or English speakers, basically, that wanted to do it. Because there is information, but a lot of it was in Catalan and in Spanish. And there just wasn't anything really useful for someone who wanted to go do it independently.
Okay. And this is not the first hike you have done. We were talking about some things before we started recording.
True. It's not my first rodeo.
That's a whole different show.
Yeah. Actually, the first big kind of long distance hike I did was the Camino de Santiago. Mm-hmm. And that's what really got this idea of long distance hiking or longer hiking under my skin. And I think that took me 5 weeks or something like that. But it was just such a great experience. And I finished it and I thought, how can I do this again? But I'm someone that does not like to do the same thing twice. So even though lots of people just go back and do the Camino de Santiago over and over again, ever since I finished, I had been on a quest to find other places for people to go and do similar type hikes. So, I mean, obviously you can hike anywhere in the world, but the Camino de Santiago is this really interesting hike that you can easily hike from village to village each day. And you can kind of go far, you can go short. There's villages about every 5 miles. You can have your luggage carried for you if you want. So you don't necessarily have to camp or cook out every night or anything like that. So I like, maybe it's as I get older, I'm like, I like that kind of hiking.
Well, see, I liked it much more when you talked about just having somebody else carry my luggage. So
yeah, I do photography. So I find having someone carry my luggage and I can focus on photography and just the hiking and having a bed to sleep in at night. And I don't have to carry food and all that kind of stuff. That's what I really enjoy. And so I was looking for similar hikes like that, that I could do in other places in the world. And actually, I then did the Lycian Way in Turkey, or I did half of it. It was also like a 4 week hike. I did 2 weeks of it, thinking that that would be really similar. And it was a wonderful hike. However, that was one where you had to camp and you had to carry your own food for a few days before you'd get into a village. The villages were just further apart. So I enjoyed it, but it wasn't quite that same experience.
And we do have an episode on that. In fact, we have an episode with the people you were hiking with. So
yes. And it's a great hike. It's just a little bit more rugged, right. I would say. And so when I came across this day hike that I did on the Camino Ronda in Costa Brava, I looked at that and I talked to some of the people there and I thought, I think this is it. I think this is a nice alternative that fits that style of long distance hiking, that you could do portions of it in a week, or you could do the whole thing easily in 2 weeks. So it made it more accessible to people.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little more about where you are. Sure, you're on the coast of Spain.
Yes. So the Costa Brava in Spain is basically the northeast of Spain.
North of Barcelona.
Yep. It lies in the region of Catalonia, which mm-hmm. I'm sure many people have heard of. And then within Catalonia, there's a province called Girona. There's also a city called Girona in mm-hmm. that province, which is the main city. But the province of Girona is really made up of the Costa Brava and the Pyrenees. So the Costa Brava, which basically means wild coast, is the coastline, is that Mediterranean coastline. And I'm going to say it probably runs from Blanes to Portbou. And Portbou is the last town right at the French border. And that's about 135 miles or so of coastline that mm-hmm. I would call Costa Brava. And that's exactly what this hike is. So hopefully that kind of orients you.
Okay. So in terms of logistics, where did you start?
Well, I actually started in Lloret de Mar.
Oh, okay. Sure.
Yeah. You should be familiar with
I have been to Lloret de Mar, which is very much a beach town.
Yes. Yeah. And a touristy beach town.
A very touristy beach town. There's some pretty beaches, some pretty parts of town, and then some more seedy parts of town, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of reminded me of a Las Vegas in a way.
I would think of it's more like think of a destination in the U.S. that people go to for spring break. This is Spain's version of that.
And so it was a good place to start because I didn't have to stay overnight there. Not that it's horrible. It's a lovely town.
No. There are parts of town that I didn't like as much. But
but that's where we started. I actually hiked with my father, and we can talk about mm-hmm. that in a little bit. But we could have started in Blanes, which Blanes is the town just south of there. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that we did is we had 2 weeks. And when we looked at the whole thing, we decided we wanted to really maximize our hike for the best scenic views. Okay. And so that meant that, and we didn't have enough days to do the whole thing from Blanes to Portbou, but we could kind of pick and choose how we wanted to do it and connect the little disconnects with taxi, which were not many. And then we started a town later than what you could if you started at the beginning. So we started at Lloret de Mar.
And you say the disconnects in your plan, or the trail doesn't go through in a couple places yet?
The disconnects in our plan. Okay. Definitely.
Got it.
However, we will need to talk about the trails because this is a little bit different. Mm-hmm. It's kind of hard to explain, but it's not necessarily all the Camino Ronda. So we kind of have to back up into the history. The Camino Ronda, well, what started as small footpaths along the cliffs, basically, mm-hmm. connecting all the fishing villages, that's what started it. And it was in the 19th century. And so these little footpaths, some of them were very treacherous, but this is how these different little fishing villages in the area were connected. Then it evolved into kind of a police and surveillance border patrol route in the 20th century to basically stop smuggling along the Catalan coast. And in fact, that's how it got the name Camino de Ronda, because Ronda actually means like patrol.
Okay.
That's the history of them. The thing is that after the 1950s, the paths really fell into disrepair. So in lieu of really all the urban development that was going on. So as you know, there's all these little, what we used to call fishing villages. Now they're these lovely little beach towns peppered up the coast. And so as those developed, the stuff in between just fell into disrepair, the paths. And that's why it's kind of fun to be talking about this now, because now there's really an effort to reinstate the Camino Ronda footpaths that connect all the modern day villages now and run up the whole coast. But the problem is that it is not fully connected yet with the historic Camino Ronda. I kind of refer to this as a coastal path hike because it's really a combination of Camino Ronda, the ancient paths, and then other paths, mainly something called the GR92. And the GR92 is, you might have heard of the Grand Randonnée European Long Distance Path System. So these are very well-marked paths and are maintained all throughout Europe. And so this GR92 actually runs up the Catalan coast too. And in fact, it shares some of the same trail as the Camino Ronda, but where the Camino Ronda is either not been repaired or too dangerous, then the GR92 kind of goes back inland and you follow that. So It's really kind of a combination of both of these that make up the whole coastal path. And they're easy to follow. It sounds confusing, but it's not. When you're on the paths, it's actually pretty easy.
Okay. That being said, let's get started. What are we going to see?
Ooh, you're going to see some of the prettiest coastline. You're on the Mediterranean. And
you did this what time of year, first of all?
We did it in May.
Okay.
Or it's right at the beginning of, I would say, their busier season. We were still in the shoulder season, which was nice. And it was a little cooler, of course, because it can get quite warm around that area in the summer. So I really enjoy hiking in like shoulder seasons because there's not as many people on trails and it's just not as hot. The one downside of that is the Mediterranean water hadn't quite warmed up to the point where you just wanted to like go jump in yet.
Sure.
So if you end up doing the hike later in the year, the summer or say the fall, the water's warm and you just stop along any of these little coves and beaches and jump in whenever you want. So what is there to see? It's this beautiful connection of coastline that one of my favorite things about the Costa Brava are all these little hidden coves and beaches. It's cliffy, it's rocky. So the scenery is stunning. And then you can hike down into these little coves where the trail takes you and you're in this gorgeous turquoise colored water beach and you're the only ones there. So there's that lovely solitude about it. It's not big like community beaches or anything like that. The other real cool thing about this area is the coastal towns. Because you can have this nice combination of like nature and urban in a way. I mean, these are not big towns. These are small towns, but there's some of the best food in the world there for sure. So you've got great food, really lovely little hotels, fun fishing history, and beautiful views in between. And for me, the reason why I love hiking is it's a slow way to travel. It's a way to really kind of understand an area. And so it's just that you're not rushing through it. It's a slow way to see everything along the coast.
Okay.
And meet people, of course, along the way.
And we're going to have to get a little more specific. So let's get specific with some of the villages. So what stands out for you as some of the prettiest spots along the road?
My first one was actually the first day when we walked from not Lloret de Mar, but we walked into Tossa de Mar. And Tossa de Mar is one of the only medieval villages that's on the coast. So it still has its old town intact. When you're approaching it from the trail, from the cliffs coming in, it actually kind of looks like a sandcastle. It's really cute. So you've got big towers and the walls of the medieval city, and there's the old city, and then there's, of course, the new city. But that was definitely one of the most picturesque places.
And I'm going to guess it's like up on a cliff or something?
Yes.
Medieval cities, there were pirates. And so if you had a city near the coast, it had to be safe.
Exactly. And in fact, there's a little piece of the trail that you come down in and you walk across this little hidden beach. And the history of that beach, it's a tiny little beach, is that that's how the pirates used to come in and try to attack. So it was kind of unseen. But yeah, the old medieval city is up on the cliff face. That was really a treat. I would say some of my other favorite places. Palamos is a really interesting town. It's got a huge fishing history. So there's a fishing museum there. Fishing auction.
You say a fishing museum. What does one see at a fishing museum? I'm assuming it's not, hey, here's that fish I caught. No. Let's see how big it is.
No, it's really the history of the area.
Okay.
So it's the history of the fishing in the area, which is kind of appropriate because here you are walking along these old ancient paths that used to connect them. And this is what the fishermen used to use.
And what did you learn about the history of the fishing in the area?
Wow. That one's a hard one. But I mean, it was just these small little villages and that's how they got by. And it's very much still intact today in many ways. The area is known for their seafood. So most of the fish that are being caught around that area are staying in the area and being used locally. It's not like they have a huge export business or anything like that.
Right. Well, and I know I did a hike on the coast, well, probably part of the route that you did during the first T-Bex that was there from Jafranc to... Calella de Palafrugell or something like that. And I have pictures of the beaches with all of these small fishing boats, not big boats, you know, maybe 10-foot long fishing boats just covering the beaches because I was there later in the day, obviously, when the fishermen had their boats put away.
Yeah, they're all like little wooden boats. And like I said, it's still very alive and well. In fact, we actually stayed two nights in Tossa de Mar.
Okay.
And one of the mornings, because there's some day hikes you can do out of there that are really pretty, but one of the mornings I got up early and walked along the beach and you can see all the fishermen leaving for the day.
Sure.
There are still very small individual guys, and then there are, of course, some bigger commercial ones, but it's just a neat little area for fishing, I think. I've never gone out and fished there, though, now that I think about it, which would be fun, too. So,
okay. Other villages that stand out in your memory?
Without a doubt, Cadaqués. So Cadaqués is further north. You might have heard of it before because it's famous for, it was the summer home of Dalí. And so there is a museum there right outside of Cadaqués. That little village, it's hard to drive to. It's really hard to hike to. It was a long hike. That was my longest hiking day. Beautiful scene. So that's kind of at the point where the landscape changes. So further south, hiking, it's a lot of trees and cliffs, like really high cliffs. And once you get up to that area, Roses and Cadaqués, it now changes because this is where the Pyrenees basically
come to the sea.
Exactly. So you've lost all trees for the most part. It's very rocky.
Hmm.
And you can even see like the type of rock. I'm no geologist, but the type of rock changes. It becomes this porous. It's very different. And no trees. And then that's where you got Capdecreos. And Capdecreos is the easternmost outcrop of Spain. And it's this beautiful little cape that has a lighthouse on it. That hike, you can actually, that's a short hike, short hiking day if you want, from Cadaqués to Capdecreos. And it's really beautiful. But it is like, there's no trees. It's very bushy, really rugged plants and stuff like that. But they still have all the little coves and beaches. It's just has a whole different feel to it.
Well, and you were saying that there's no trees there. By contrast, then the area south of that, at least from my pictures, is either little tiny towns and cliffs or trees.
Yes. Yep. You're absolutely right. That's actually one of the fun things about doing the entire walk, if you have the time, is you get to see that change. And it is really kind of cool to see because it's very different between the north and the south. And even though it's only 100 mile or so, 135 mile area that we're talking about, it does change. So yeah, I loved Cadaqués. Cadaqués is kind of like it reminds me of a Santorini in a way. It's got all these little white homes and it's built on these hills and the cathedral sticks out lovely. There's some Michelin star restaurants there. There's great gin and tonics and a beautiful little waterfront. But then just over the hill, then you've got all of the Dalí museum and home and stuff like that.
You know, great gin and tonics usually implies a British expat community there.
Oh, I could do a whole show on gin and tonics in Spain or in Costa Brava. Yeah, it does. And when I first went there years ago, it was probably one of the biggest surprises to me of that region is how popular gin is there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that they necessarily distill a bunch of it there. There are makers there. But Spaniards, they just love their gin. I mean, I don't understand why, but they have completely gin bars. So you can go into a bar and they'll have 100 different bottles of gin and that's all they do.
Hmm.
They will show you how to make a proper gin and tonic, which is not at all how we do it in America. We make very improper gin and tonics according to them, which I would have to say they're right.
What is the difference between a proper and an improper gin and tonic?
Well, first of all, we in America at least probably normally put in lime or lemon or something like that.
Okay.
Nope. That is not allowed. We do not put juice in a gin and tonic. You can put a rind in, but not the juice. You would never squeeze the juice in.
Okay.
And it also starts with the glass. I don't know if we really have gin and tonic glasses here. It could be anything could be used. But in Spain, in that part of Spain, it's very much about this giant kind of goblet. Like it's actually quite heavy. And it's served in a goblet that has really thick glass because it's all about keeping the drink and the gin very cold. But you don't want the ice to melt. So they use these great big pieces of ice. You want to keep the drink cold, but you don't want the ice to melt and then dilute it because then that changes the whole taste, apparently.
Hmm.
And then there's the different kinds of gin, obviously all have different flavors and tastes, but it doesn't stop there. They also have an equal amount of different types of tonic.
Okay.
With different flavors and stuff like that. So when you order a gin and tonic in the Costa Brava, which I had plenty of after the hikes, you have to name your gin and your tonic, which is a little confusing.
Okay.
Instead of putting, you know, squeezing lime into it, they would put maybe peppercorns or different, or thyme or whatever, they have different ways they garnish it. But that all depends on what gin and what tonic you chose. And then the bartender figures all that out. Very complicated.
The odd thing with that is the whole history of the gin and tonic is this is just people taking their medicine. That literally it was taking your quinine tonic so that you would try and prevent malaria for people who are stationed in tropical areas. So it's odd that it turns into a big separate whole culture.
Yeah. Like I said, I don't really know how it started, but it's kind of like martinis in New York. It has this stigma. Gin tonics in the Costa Brava and Catalonia are very well known. Hmm. So if you go there, make sure you have one.
Now, it also looks like when you were up in that area, you were hiking through one of the national parks in Spain.
Yes, we hiked through a few national parks, but I don't know if I'm going to know the names right off the top of my head. Because lots of times when you're hiking, you don't know when you enter the national park and when you leave it. It's all kind of the same. But yes, we did. Some of the trails go through national parks. Absolutely. Those are the Camino Ronda trails for the most part, and they are well maintained in there. Yeah. I'll also say that we talked a little bit about south and north. You see a lot more people in the south along the trail than you do in the north.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
I don't know exactly why, but it's just the more popular area. So we barely saw anyone once we got up past Cap de Creus, because we still had about 4 or 5 days left after that, and you didn't see many people at all.
You just personally have gotten off the road full time. Not that you're not still traveling or travel blogging, but you have got a home base now. As you were hiking through here and all of those thoughts of maybe it's time to get off the road were going through, which town did you almost stop in and say, this is it? It doesn't get any better than this.
Cadaqués is definitely one that would be on my list. But the other one I would say is Begur.
Okay.
It's a little off the coast, actually, and it's way up high on a hill. So you really have to earn your keep if you're going to hike up there. maybe that's why I liked it so much, because I actually made it. But it is the hardest, most steepest climb of the hike. Mm-hmm. When you're trying to hike up to Begur. But up there, there's also, it's an older medieval town. It's not as well intact, but there is a fort there that you can still get up and see the view of the whole area. And you see a lot more of the inland farming area, which is really beautiful. So you get a different kind of view than you've been walking along the coast the whole time, which is nice. But Begur, I don't know what it was. It's like this old colonial feel. Strangely, there's a lot of Cuban influence there.
I was going to mention that if you didn't. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Just the style of homes are different. The people are even a little different, you know, because you've got either people who maybe spent time in Cuba and came back or people from Cuba that came. You might even know more about the history of why that
is. Well, most of it is just what you said, the first one. There's a style of house that is there called a Cubano house, and it is from people who were from Spain who went to Cuba as part of the colonial process and then came back and brought back with them some of that New World style. And so in, I think, La Franque, for instance, or Ya Franque, I'm not sure how to, they weren't consistent with their double L's in that region, which drove me crazy. That area had a lot of the houses along the coast were these Cubano style houses. And it is a New World style house, but back in the Old World from those people who were expats. I don't know what that makes them. Just pets at that
You're
point.
Right. They just came back. You're absolutely right. Yeah, it's such a cute town. Just a different feel than the rest of that area, definitely. Mm-hmm. And people were really nice. We actually had a day off there, too. We took a couple of rest days. My dad, who was hiking with me, is 80. So it was good to have a few rest days. He probably did better than I did, though, honestly.
Now, I'm guessing if he's 80, he's also in pretty decent shape.
Yeah, he has good knees.
Okay, that'd be useful.
Yeah, it is useful on this trail, I will say that, because it's a lot of up and down, but not like super steep, but just up and down. Yeah, we had a rest day there and it was great. It was a good place to go, you know, do laundry and all that kind of stuff and just stay off your feet, but wander around the town and do the fort and stuff like that. We stayed at a wonderful, wonderful hotel there called Agua Clara. Mm-hmm. And that is one of these old colonial style homes. And that's what made it so cool. So it was just, the rooms were really interesting. It was built in 1866, I think is what they told me. And then they decorated it in a very eclectic style. It was comfortable. They had a little restaurant there that we went to on a Saturday night. It's only open at night. And it was the place to go apparently in Bigor because all the locals like were there. It was definitely a local place that people knew, like, you know, come here for the weekend or something, you know, for dinner. So it was great. Really cute. I would have stayed there a whole week.
Well, now you've mentioned restaurant and we've hinted at food, I think, three times so far. I think we have to talk about what am I eating when I'm in this area, Costa Brava. Seafood, I assume, but
yes,
more specifically.
Well, each town, each little village is known for different seafood typically. Okay. So the best thing to do is when you get into that village, ask, what is it? Because they each have a fish or something like that. So for example, in La Scala, it is the home of the anchovy. And La Scala anchovies are known certainly all over Europe. I don't think we know as much about them here, but they're very well known. They're known to be some of the highest quality. So they have a bunch of anchovy factories around that little town. And in fact, we actually even went to visit one, which was really fun. Definitely a highlight.
And that's a normal trip that anybody can stop and see the... Okay.
Absolutely. So there's actually a museum there too, which is really cool. I think it's called the Anchovy and Salt Museum. And so you go in there. Well, this is, it talks about how they preserved it and so on. And sure, that's how the anchovies are still done this day. And so you can go in there and learn about all the history. So we did that. And then if you do want to actually go see a factory and tour a factory, they'll give you a list, especially like if you're looking for an English speaking place.
And you say the people
museum.
The people at the museum. Okay, got it.
Yeah, the museum. And that's probably the best place to go to get that information, I think.
Okay.
These are factories. They're not necessarily like big tourism joints. They do obviously offer tours, but it's just one off whoever shows up, which is what makes it fun. So we went to the one that they recommended. We just walked over there and did about an hour or so tour of learning all about how they prepare and package the anchovies and the different quality and the grades. And then, of course, we got to taste, which was great. And then we bought a bunch to bring home. Yeah, it was great. My dad and I love anchovies, so it was actually just perfect. But that's an example of how like that particular town has a very specific type of seafood that they're known for. But most of the time we'd go into the villages and just ask around and what's your best fish here? And they'd bring it out and we ate a lot of whole fish. I'm trying to think. So that's all along the coast. There are points of the trail where you actually go inland a little bit into more of the farming communities. And there you get more of the meat and heartier kind of farming type food, right? So there was plenty of that kind of stuff too, if you're not.
And was there seafood. A favorite non-fish dish then?
In Pals, which is another medieval town, we actually stayed outside of Pals. Pals is a very popular tourist spot. We stayed a little bit outside in the countryside at an old farmhouse that they've redone into a hotel, Esportal. And the restaurant there is quite well known. Their chef specializes in rice dishes. So there you can have like rabbit and rice, or you can also have the seafood options too. But we stuck to the game.
Okay.
And it was great. They have a lovely wine selection. That's a more high-end restaurant, definitely. And it was just at the hotel called Esportal.
And how far in advance did you book your hotels on this route? Or how far in advance would you recommend?
It depends on that time of year that you're going to go. So when we went in May, it was completely fine. You could always find a place. Mm-hmm. If you get into June, July, and August, kind of, you've got to be well booked in advance, probably a couple months, 2-3 months, I would say. August, maybe even earlier, because August, as you know, is the month everyone.
Sure. I happen to be heading to Spain in August and it's not for the weather.
Yeah. So it kind of depends. Now, having said that, we actually used, because as I said in the beginning, there's not a lot of information on this trail. And so we used a local provider that specializes in the Camino Ronda. And he's really the only one that does it, but he's made that his mission. Yeah. And the company is called Camino Ronda.
Okay.
And what they do is actually really cool because they offer you all kinds of different ways you can do it. Either they will book your hotels for you. If you want high end or medium or budget, they kind of have all that figured out.
And the range is what? I mean, are there hostels on the low end and how many stars on the high end?
Well, it can really range because each town's a little different.
Sure. Yeah.
But definitely hostels were one of the choices.
Okay.
Might not get a hostel in every town, but some of the towns, that's all they had.
And did you ever have an infinity pool? So that's really kind of, you know.
No.
Okay. Was that an option though?
Oh, Maybe. I don't know. That's hard to say because we're the right by, you know, most of the places were had balconies that looked right out on the beach.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. I'm not real sure. I mean, there are definitely high end hotels in some of those places like Palo Frugel and all those places, definitely. But there's also medium and budget options too. So the nice thing about Camino de Ronda is, yes, you can say, we're going to hike this ourselves. We don't need a guide.
Sure.
And we will pay you to book all the hotels and transport our luggage from hotel to hotel. And they're going to give you an actual map and they're going to give you a GPS files that you can add to your phone or whatever. That's what I did. That will make sure that you never get lost.
Okay. That was getting lost was going to be my next question. So that's useful now. Yeah.
We did. Yeah. I mean, it was really helpful with the GPS, but we never got in too much trouble. Like
the signage was pretty good.
Yeah, it was. It really was. Between the GR92 and the old Camino de Ronda, they have different signage. One is red and white and one is green and white. But yes, once you kind of hone in on what to look for, sometimes the markings are on trees, sometimes they're on a rock, sometimes your brain starts to think in that way. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to find then after that. But we also, as a backup, had these GPS maps. So it was kind of nice. They will organize all that for you. Now, I will say that they specialize in certain routes more southerly. So,
okay. So further south than where you started.
No. But they don't do the north as much. They don't do Cadaqués.
Okay.
As much, I guess is what I'm saying. So theirs starts in San Feliu, which is just a town past Tossa de Mar. So they've got a nice route that starts in San Feliu and it goes through three different towns. You can either do it in 2 days or 3 days. And then my dad and I actually did it in 4 days. So you can take as much time as you want. Mm-hmm. And I think it ends at Tamariu.
So you could even make a long weekend hike and don't even have to commit a week if you have less time. Or if you want to add this on to a trip that includes Girona or some of the other things that we've talked about previously in Costa Brava. Okay, excellent.
And in fact, speaking of Girona, Camino de Ronda, that company also has a route that they sell for GPS and so on, and they'll help with the hotels, that is a circuit that actually starts in Girona.
Oh,
you walk out to the coast to San Feliu and up the coast for like 2 or 3 days and then back into Girona. So that's more of like a week.
Okay. And Girona's like 20 miles from the coast, roughly,
yeah,
somewhere
that's
in that
about
range.
Right. 20 or 30. Yep. Mm-hmm. And once again, they kind of do all the logistics for you. And that's a nice way to be able to see the coast because you get those like three beautiful days of the coastal area. And then you also get that inland kind of rolling hills and so on, which is a whole different feel. So, and you get Girona, which is great. So that's a neat option too.
Okay. And it seemed like some of the inland trails might even be decent bike trails. The coastal sounds a little more steep than would work as well. Yeah.
You could never do the coastal on a bike, but yes, there's probably some inland biking that would be a little bit easier. I mean, and on this, even on the coastal trails, there were some where you'd be in residential areas or you'd be kind of walking along the side of a busier highway or something, but that was pretty few and far between. It was much more like you're in the woods, you're right out at the coast.
Sure.
So yeah, it was rugged and a lot of steps, like I said, a lot of up and down because as I said, you kind of go see all these beaches and these coves. Well, to do that, you're dropping down into these coves and then you got to go back up.
Right. Unfortunately, yeah.
I know. It's like, oh, in fact, one of the things I say about this hiking, which is very different than like the Camino de Santiago, which is just straight line across northern Spain. Mm-hmm. I compare it to if you look at your hand and if you're trying to get from your thumb to your pinky, you can't go straight. You're going to have to go out and around every one of these fingers. And that's what this is like. So it's not like super efficient hiking, but it's beautiful because each of those fingers are the peninsulas and the coves and so on.
Excellent. You skipped some parts. You got in a taxi. What did you skip and why? And how did you know to skip those is the other question.
So as I said, we used Camino de Ronda to help us with some of the hotels. And they actually went a little bit further for us and helped us organize the whole thing up to Port Bou, which I said isn't their special. They don't have a canned map and stuff for that, but they helped us do it.
And Port Bou is actually the French-Spanish border. So that's up as far as you can go in Spain. We didn't talk about that last little part.
Yeah, that is where we ended.
Okay.
Which is also a cute little town. Camino de Ronda actually kind of helped us a little bit say like, oh, you know, you only have so many days. So I would skip this piece because it's a flat day of 15 miles of walking. And if you don't have time, that's the piece I would take out. So
got it. Okay.
The big chunk that we took out was La Scala to Roses.
Okay. So it was the Gulf of Roses, actually, that you skipped mostly.
Yes. So that Gulf of Roses, if you look at it on the map, is all sand. And it'll take you all day to walk across sand. So you can do that, which is kind of the original Cami to Ronda Trail. Or you can do the GR92, which cuts you back into kind of some wetland and stuff like that. But it is all it's a little bit more mundane. But it's, you know, if I had the time, I would have done it all. But we didn't. So that was definitely a place where we just kind of skipped through. We skipped from Tossa de Mar to San Feliu. We took a taxi that day too. And that's really because that old ancient Camino Ronda trail is not walkable. That's one where it's in too much disrepair or it's too dangerous.
Okay.
So your only option was to go out the GR92. And that actually took you quite a ways out to come back in. And so we decided once again to maximize our time and our views. We would skip that part and just take a taxi.
Okay.
Yeah. And then there were a couple other times where we didn't really skip anything, but we used a taxi service to help us do the trail. So in Cadaqués, we walked out to Cap de Creus, which is it's not a long walk that day, but we walked out there and then we got a taxi come pick us up at Cap de Creus at the lighthouse and bring us back to Cadaqués. And we stayed overnight that night again there. And then the taxi got up in the morning, took us back out to Cap de Creus, and we started from there. And then we had a long, that was a really long day. I want to say it was a good 8 to 10 hour hike that day. So we couldn't have done it all in one day. It would have been really hard. So we used a taxi to just kind of get us back and forth to the hotel and then start us where we left off.
Got it. Okay.
So you can do that kind of stuff. That's the nice thing. But honestly, that was really the only day where that was an issue, where it was just kind of too far to do in a day. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, all the other ones, I mean, there are plenty of little towns along the way that you can stop in.
Sure.
You know, I had our route that we did and where we stopped, but there were a ton of other options too. You could slice and dice it how you want.
You've been on the road for a while. You have seen a few places. What surprised you?
What surprised me was really how few people knew about it.
Oh, okay. You could count me into that. I believe our emails were, what are you talking about? And
As you said, I've been on the road for a very long time. I've been doing a lot of travel all over the world. And you get tired of being around all the popular places sometimes. And you want to find these hidden secrets, these gems. And that's what this was. And I think that's what surprised me so much is how beautiful it was, how accessible it was, and how few people were on it. And granted, like I said, this was in May, so we were in the off season, but I'm pretty sure that like spring and fall, that's what you're going to find. It might be a little different in the summer. But I think that was the biggest surprise. And one of the things that I kept thinking about was years ago, I had done the Cinque Terre hike.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And it's so crowded.
Super popular.
Especially in the weekends in the summer.
Yes. So, you know, exactly.
Yeah. Although the steeper parts get less crowded, I noticed.
<That's true. laughs> That is very true. But that's what this reminded me of. This had everything the Cinque Terre had. It had the same kinds of views, beautiful little fishing villages, food, wine, atmosphere, culture, but not that crowded. And that was the key to me. And so I always, in fact, that's one of the things when people ask me like, oh, where should I go? What should I do? I always try to give them alternative, like, don't go to Cinque Terre, go to Costa Brava, you know, go hike the coastal path. Because it's just such a nice surprise when you get there and you can really enjoy the nature and you're not, don't feel like you're in Times Square.
Wait, Times Square is nice if you want to be in Times Square, but
not when I'm hiking.
Not so much. Anything else we want to cover before we hit some of our last wrap-up questions?
A couple of things. The difficulty. People always ask me, well, how difficult is it? I describe it as a moderate hike.
Okay.
It is not as easy as the Camino de Santiago.
Okay.
The Camino de Santiago is, like I said, straight and generally flat. Here, I would recommend that you have proper hiking boots because...
Good knees.
Yeah. And poles.
Yeah.
Because it's not like you're scrambling on your hands and feet, but there's a lot of uneven surface. I did a graphic on my site. I took pictures of my hiking boots on all these different like terrains and surfaces. And then I kind of put it all together. So you can kind of see like some of it's very easy. Some of it's very rocky. So it is a moderate hike. And it's not like you're climbing in high elevation, but you are going up and down these cliffs. And sometimes there's stairs. And sometimes it's just you kind of follow the path up and it's a little rocky outcrop. But I always come back to, yes, my father is in shape, probably more than an 80-year-old, average 80-year-old, but he did it. And we just went slow. We went slower probably than normal. And I mean, it's possible. So It's not super difficult. It's not like Nepal. It's somewhere in between.
Okay.
So there's that. The other thing I would say is, as I mentioned in the beginning, there's not a lot of information on this hike because it's, you know, it's just not as well known. There is one really great book that is in English, and I think it's called The Coastal Paths. It actually has detailed maps and all the trail stuff. It does not really talk as much about hotels and other stuff, but it's much more of like a hiking guidebook. So there's that. That's really great. Hard to find sometimes because it's not, the English version is not always available on Amazon, but it does exist. And then as part of this, for me, I actually put together an ebook that is high level. So it doesn't have the detailed maps and the climbs and all that kind of stuff, but it gives you all the basics of here's the routes you can do, here's the distances, here's the difficulty, here's the gear you need to bring and places we stayed. It covers all this stuff that we've kind of been talking about. So if you want to plan your own vacation or your own hike, you can. And now there's information at least.
In terms of gear, so you've mentioned hiking boots and poles. I'm assuming a fish fork. What else am I going to need?
Fish fork, a hat.
A hat,
definitely
sure.
A hat. I'm trying to think if there's anything else really specific to it, you know, than what you wouldn't normally have on a hike. No, I mean, it's general hiking stuff. You want to make sure you've got water solution. But the good thing is, because you're always not far from civilization, there's plenty of places to fill up water and stuff like that. So you don't have to carry your water for the whole day. You kind of have half of it and then you can fill up. A good day pack, a camera. The views are amazing. I did a lot of photography.
I'm assuming that those people who have the enhanced version show have been watching your wonderful photography that I haven't really looked at yet. So, but I'm sure it was gorgeous. So
it'll make them want to go.
Yeah, exactly.
It is. It's just that beautiful and all the little beaches and stuff.
And the most beautiful spot?
I'm going to say Tamariu. And I say that to be a little bit different because Tamariu is a small town that we hiked into. The hike to get there was really pretty. And it's just not quite as well known as like Palamos or Palafrugell or those places. But I thought it was just as beautiful. And it has this big like crescent beach and the little buildings that surround it. It was lovely. I just liked the environment there. It was a little bit more chill.
Okay. And obviously, if you're doing this in the summer, pack your swimsuit.
Yes, definitely.
And it's Spain, so you don't have to pack as much swimsuit.
No. That is something to note. I'm so glad you brought that up because there are plenty of nude beaches along this trail, which always makes it interesting when you're hiking with your dad. It was a little awkward at first.
If you don't have a nude beach, any beach in Spain is potentially a topless beach.
True.
Not all of the photos that I took on my hike are up here on my website. They are edited.
But you're right. So you have the normal topless thing. The trail takes you right through some nude beaches too. Plenty of them. Which, whatever, not a big deal.
Just something people should know is why I brought it up. Yeah.
I do think that's important.
We don't want you to walk through the first one and go, why didn't they mention this?
And they did. Actually, the people at Camino Ronda did mention that.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
We did have a little bit of knowledge of that. But it was always kind of a shock once we came to the first one and you just kind of divert your eyes. And it's funny. My dad and I had fun with it. It was fun.
And, you know, just for anybody who has a mental image there, it's never the people you want to see nude anyway.
True. So true.
Know, my quote from Malaga was, you know, grandma has a new bathing suit, a new bikini. Why won't she wear all of it? But so.
Yes. Well, and that also brings up, I mean, as part of the trails go over beaches. And so you are walking in sand, which is more challenging, but not the end of the world. You can also take your boots off and walk in your bare feet if you want.
Yeah.
But it's fun. Like I love the fact that the trails go right through the middle of the beach, you know, or when the water is warmer, it's a great place to just take a break and a dip.
Right. Last couple questions. One thing that makes you laugh and say only in the Camino Ronda.
Only in the Camino Ronda. Wine is included in dinner and they bring you a whole bottle.
Oh, wow. Okay. So you're walking all day and you've got a bottle of wine at dinner. Sleeping was not a problem.
No, sleeping was never a problem. But like most of that area of Spain, they have these menu del días and
menu
of the days. Yep. And they're always cheaper, a little bit cheaper. They're normally a 3 or 4 course menu. And they even have them at the very high-end restaurants too. So it's normally a 3 or 4 course menu. And with that, you get wine. And when there's two people that order it, they'll bring you a whole bottle of wine. So just be prepared and make sure you are drinking lots of water too at the same time. But yeah, my dad and I had a good time with that.
Excellent. And if you had to summarize the Camino Ronda in three words. What three words would you use?
Picturesque.
Sure.
Tasty.
Okay.
And solitary.
Okay. Excellent. Shariat, where can people read about your travels?
Ooh, they can read about me at otsworld.com. And I have whole sections on the Camino Ronda, as well as all these other hikes I talked about.
Okay. And we'll put a link to your ebook as well.
Yeah. And the ebook is free. So no big deal there.
It's free, but is there a special offer for listeners of Amateur Traveler?
A bottle of wine. maybe an anchovy. How's that? I might have to give away fewer anchovies than I do a bottle of wines.
Shari, thanks for coming on the show and sharing with us your love for Spain and specifically for the Camino Ronda.
Thank you so much.
In news of the community, I heard from our newly appointed fact checker, Mary, about the last show that we did on the Hebrides, and we did not quite get our facts correct in terms of the Highland clearances. I believe the guest speaker didn't accurately describe some of the components of Scottish history. The clearances were a brutal time during Scottish history. It had less to do with the breakup of the clans after Culloden and more to do with the changing economics. The landowners, the lairds, some of whom were English but not all, leveraged the increasing wool prices of the 1800s to shift their land from farming to sheep production. They moved the crofters, farmers, off the land, the vast majority of whom had lived on the farm and farmed the land for centuries. The crofters were forced away with nowhere to go and virtually nothing but the clothes on their backs. Mary, thanks so much for keeping us honest. I try and do fact-checking on the fly on the show, but I don't know everything, and sometimes I obviously miss things, so thanks very much. We still have space on the Amateur Traveler trip to India coming up here in November. I hope you can join us. And with that, we're going to end this episode of Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions or corrections, send an email at tohost@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. And thanks so much for listening.
I got to see one more cathedral. I got to sit in one more cafe. I should